Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, you're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. In this throwaway culture, it's a remarkable thing that so many people hang on to their National Geographics. Those familiar yellow spines and borders hold the promise of stories that capture specific moments in time, even as their larger themes often prove deep and timeless. The magazine's parent company is among the largest nonprofit scientific and educational organizations in the world, with a focus on geography, archaeology, natural science, and environmental and historical conservation. Like many of the cultures and habitats it has documented in its 127-year history, National Geographic finds itself in a rapidly changing landscape in which readers are also viewers, listeners, and even active participants in documenting the world. And they are almost as likely to read magazines on phones or tablets as on paper. Joining us to talk about how National Geographic is positioning itself for the future is the new editor-in-chief of National Geographic Magazine and News, Susan Goldberg. Susan, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much, Chris. I'm so happy to be here.
When a publication has the kind of history that National Geographic has, do you approach the questions that you would ask yourself as an incoming editor-in-chief in a different way, given the history of the publication? Is there more import maybe to deciding that you're going to take a different tack?
Well, you know, National Geographic, like all print media, is undergoing a tremendous change. You know, this is true of newspapers. It's true of magazines. So I think what we're trying to do these days is take what's always worked for us, but bring it into the 21st century. So how do we do stories about the environment, about climate change, about species preservation, but in ways that work across all platforms so we can reach more readers than we've ever had the opportunity to reach before? You know, one thing that I think we're very lucky about is the stories that are right in the wheelhouse of what National Geographic has always covered, some of those topics I mentioned, plus science and conservation, those are topics that millennials, new readers, new audiences really care about. And so we have a tremendous opportunity to reach them.
What does it take to convince millennials who have become convinced that good content should be free that it's worth paying for a subscription?
Well, you know, we've got a lot of different ways that we can reach them. Of course, you know, we would love it if everybody would buy the magazine. And, you know, we do have 60 million readers worldwide who do read the magazine, which is printed in 40 languages. But we also understand that there are ways to reach millennials, like on Instagram or on Facebook. We have 15 million followers on Instagram. We're the biggest brand on Instagram. We have 35 million friends on Facebook. We have 10 million followers on Twitter. We have this tremendous social media outreach, and I just wish that more people realized that we were out there in those ways. You know, clearly millions of people do, but I wish everybody.
Millions more.
Yeah. I really wish everybody understood you can get a National Geographic story just about any way you want to have it.
How do you decide about the tone that your online presence will have and how much it is similar to what exists in the hard copy and the digital tablet versions and you know, the times when it's okay to really diverge from that?
Well, I think to be successful digitally, you can't just take what's in the magazine and stick it onto some other device. We need to be more sophisticated than that. And so what we do is take our stories and sometimes deconstruct them and play to the strengths of the medium in which they're presented. So we just did a story, for example, about Detroit. It's called Taking Back Detroit, and it's a wonderful story that focuses on the people who are living in Detroit, why they're living there, and how this city is coming back from this historic bankruptcy. And we took that story in print. It's got beautiful portraiture, wonderful mapping. But online, you know, those pictures come to life. You hear the voices of the people that we have these wonderful portraits of. You see the mapping. You're able to, you know, manipulate graphics. It's a different way of storytelling. And so increasingly, and online, you can also read the full story should you wish to do that. But we've got to give people other ways into our content than just the traditional one.
Talk a little bit about the collaborative process between photojournalists and writing journalists who are there to actually compose the story.
We have And I come out of the daily newspaper business. So there's a collaborative process that is lengthier and more in-depth than I've ever seen before. We create story teams for each story that we assign. And on that team is going to be a photo editor and a text editor. There's a writer. There's a graphic artist. There's often an illustrator. And these people are meeting at all times to figure out, how are we going to tell the story in a way that really plays to the strengths of National Geographic, that has the rich visual content that people expect from us, but that also really will get in depth? And then we bring our writers and our photographers together. They won't necessarily be joined at the hip for the entire story. Sometimes the photography will be broader than the story. Sometimes it'll be the other way around. But they've got to be collaborating and talking, because the strongest story is when the words and the visuals and the mapping and the digital all can work together. That's when we know we've hit a home run.
Does the photography typically drive the decision about what makes the cover?
No, actually. And if you look back at our recent covers, they're not always pure photograph. They're often photo illustration. For example, the best-selling cover that we've had so far this year was The War on Science, which was our March cover. That is a photo illustration, and, you know, with type all over the picture. So figuring out what makes the best cover is very, very tough and sometimes very humbling. we do sell most of our magazines by subscription, the vast majority. But, of course, you can always tell what works by what's happening on the newsstand.
One thing I love about the digital edition is that there's never a seam down the middle of a perfect photograph. I wonder how photographers have adjusted to the differences in editing their own work for both hard copy and digital editions.
Well, you know, our photographers are really good editors. You can see it. They are always editing their own work, and they post on our Instagram account. We have a core group of photographers who are allowed to post directly to our Instagram account. So they know, you know, they know what's good, but they work really closely with our photo editors to figure out what's the right picture. You know, it's hard to get the perfect picture for the cover. It's got to be exactly the right shape. You know, we're a small cover, and it's vertical too. And if you think about it, we really live in a horizontal world. So it can be very hard coming up with just the right picture. We do have one coming up in August, which is going to be a cover on Pope Francis, and it's timed to his visit to the United States in September. We got the most incredible picture of Pope Francis. We hung around with Pope Francis for 6 months. We were about, you know, 6 feet away from him, on and off for 6 months. We got some special photographic access. And one day Pope Francis was passing through the Sistine Chapel, and he's all by himself, and he stops in the very middle in front of the frescoes to take in the beauty of the frescoes. And our photographer, who was right behind the Pope, snaps this picture of the Pope in this empty Sistine Chapel, just surrounded by these frescoes. It is the most wonderful, moving, perfect photo for a cover I've seen in a long time.
How far out are you working, planning what will be in upcoming issues?
We work really far ahead, but we always, you know, you've got to have a plan, and then you've got to be willing and able to change your plan.
Which is where a newspaper background must be helpful.
Well, it has been helpful. I think this half of the staff really hates me, because I always think we can do things at the more last minute than they think we can do. But, you know, so we've actually got story ideas on the board for all of 2016. But we will change what's on the cover, what's in that mix. We'll change it as events dictate. We add stories that we didn't plan on having. In March, we ended up adding a story about the Syrian refugee crisis, which is just so devastating. We're at a time where there are more refugees than at any time since World War II. This seemed like an incredibly timely way to get into this story, and we had tremendous photographs from John Stanmeyer, who was at the Turkish-Syrian border, and our writer Paul Salopak. So we're able to do stories with a pretty short window and get them in.
Paul Salopak is the guy who is walking around the world.
Indeed. Paul Salopak, who is a tremendous, tremendous guy, he's walking around the world on a 7-year walk. He's starting in Ethiopia, the cradle of man, and he's going to walk all the way to the tip of South America. And he's documenting this journey along the way. This is a great example of how we're bringing digital and print together. So he's got a blog. He's connecting digitally with classrooms all over the world. And he writes for the magazine. So he's sort of like an all-platform guy with a moving classroom going around the world. And he's also one of the best writers who I've ever seen. He's a poet, really. And so I'm so thrilled by the stories that he's been able to do for us.
And he is not coming home in between?
He is not coming home in between. I went to walk with Paul for a couple of days when he was in southern Turkey, right near the Syrian border. And, you know, he and I spent a lot of time talking to these Syrian refugees and saw just how desperate the crisis was. But, you know, Paul is a unique person. I don't think that there are many people who would walk around the world, one, and then do so, and his rule is you don't come home. Mm-hmm. So we're going to go to Paul and make sure he feels really connected to us. Plus, we've got this tremendous photographer, John Stanmeyer. He will be documenting Paul's journey the entire time, so they have a really great bond.
You've actually done a fair amount of traveling to the places where important stories are happening. Theoretically, you could stay in your office all the time. What do you see as the benefit of that for you as editor?
Well, just like you need to send reporters out of the office. I think I should get out of the office every now and then too. When I was the editor of the San Jose Mercury News or the Plain Dealer, sometimes I'd walk out of my office and I'd see all these reporters sitting in the office, and I'd say, "Get the heck out of here!
Right.
You know, go cover the community." And I really do feel the same way. So walking with Paul Salopek makes me understand not just what he's going through, you know, as a staff member, you know, and a valued colleague. But also I can see for myself, wow, this crisis of refugees is just unbelievable. You know, there's nothing like touching it and seeing it and feeling it to understand yourself. I mean, I went to Rome to talk to the Pope's people. The Pope has a lot of people, as you might imagine, to talk about getting access to the Pope. I think that helped us get access. I went with our photographer and with our writer, and we all went to talk with the Pope's people, and I think they were able to see, these are legitimate people. These are serious storytellers. These aren't people who are out just for a cheap story. They want to do an in-depth story on the Pope. And I think being there gives you a credibility that you don't have otherwise.
Are the Pope's people easy to deal with? I mean, I would imagine they're very protective of his time.
Well, I couldn't speak for all of them, of course, but the Pope's people who we met with were incredibly helpful. The other people who were very helpful to us were the U.S. ambassadors who are based in Rome. We have three of them. We have the ambassador to Italy, the ambassador to the Vatican, and the ambassador to the United Nations food programs. They're all based in Rome. And so, you know, they know the Pope's people, and so they were able to help us get that access too.
Is there competition among the ambassadors who are there in Italy to be the best ambassador possible?
I couldn't say. They seemed very cooperative with each other and really good friends.
We're speaking this hour with Susan Goldberg. She is editor-in-chief of National Geographic Magazine and News. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. And if you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or you can email think@kera.org. You can also find me on Twitter. This week, you can follow the hashtag ThinkInDC. This is the last day of our shows in DC. And you can get a look at the action behind the scenes at the KERA Think Tumblr. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
Live from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with National Geographic magazine and news editor-in-chief Susan Goldberg. If you've got a question about National Geographic, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Susan, what is the relationship between the magazine and news divisions that you run and the other National Geographic properties that people may be aware of, the TV and the publishing and that sort of thing? They're independent but part of the same organization?
There's basically three legs of the National Geographic stool. You know, one is the storytelling leg. So that's the magazine. There's National Geographic's main magazine. There's the travel magazine. We have two kids magazines, National Geographic Kids and Little Kids. And we have a books division. You know, and we've got then, as you noted, the television station. We produce television for the channel, and we work with them, and they decide to do shows sometimes about the stories that we have in the magazine. So it's a collaborative, cooperative relationship. You know, we're not always doing the same thing, but one of the things we've tried to do since the arrival of our new CEO, Gary Nell, is to work more collectively. So you've got this sort of storytelling branch of the organization. Then you've got our science and exploration operation. So we've got scientists and explorers all over the world who we fund to do, you know, scientific investigation and exploration, and they're out there making discoveries. One of the things we're trying to do is write about those more often. Again, being one National Geographic. And then finally, we've got our education arm. You know, geographic education is immensely important to, you know, basic literacy, we believe. And, you know, we have the Net GOB, which is kind of the fun part of it. But we also work with a lot of teachers in a lot of classrooms all over the country. So those are the three parts of National Geographic. And we're trying to figure out how can we coordinate together more successfully.
I was surprised in doing a bit of research to learn how small your permanent staff is based on, you know, how many different really well-respected journalists have actually published things in National Geographic.
It, you know, it's sort of the opposite model than the one I came from in newspapers, where you have a large permanent staff and you have you use freelancers only on the rarest of occasions. This is the exact opposite. So really, the people who work for us are editors and photo editors and, you know, graphics illustrators and artists. But the writers for the vast majority of the stories and almost all of the photographs are contract workers. Some of them, you know, we've been contracting with for 25 or 30 years, so it's almost like they're staffers, but they are contracts for stories. One thing that is a bit of an adjustment, as we produce news and information in real time digitally, and that becomes a bigger and bigger part of what we do, you do really need to have a staff whose time you control. Like a newspaper, like a radio station, when stuff happens and you want to cover it, you need somebody who actually works for you, rather than you might, you know, call up a freelancer and they could perhaps not be available for 2 weeks. So you need them right then. So when we have the terrible tragedy in Nepal with the earthquake and avalanche, you know, we have people who work for us who are helping pull together those stories, because those are the kinds of stories that are in our wheelhouse that we need to be expert on and that we need to tell in real time.
So will we see that in soon online and then in an upcoming edition of the magazine?
We've already covered the Nepal story since the day it happened. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure yet whether or not we'll end up doing something in the magazine. If you look back at the last avalanche on Everest, which was, you know, about a year ago, that killed 16 Sherpas, I think that happened on April 18th of 2014. So we were immediately on that story online, and then we we went back to Nepal and we ended up doing a story for the magazine that ran in November, probably the most in-depth story about that tragedy that had happened. So, you know, we're going to let this story unfold. We're going to keep covering it, in the coming week or two. And then I think we're going to sit down and figure out, should we also do a story for the magazine? But increasingly, you're going to see stories that are breaking in the short term. And if they're in our wheelhouse, we're going to cover them in real time. And then we'll roll up the more elevated, deeper, richer version of that story into the magazine some months later.
My guest is Susan Goldberg, editor-in-chief of National Geographic Magazine and News. Our telephone number to join the conversation is 1-800-933-5372. We have Garvin on the line now in Dallas. Hello, Garvin.
Hello, Ms. Boyd. I'm a long-time admirer and first-time caller.
Welcome.
Thank you, Ms. Goldberg.
Welcome to the show, Garvin. Go right ahead.
Thank you. Ms. Goldberg,
you're
I have
us?
A question about... access you guys are able to or not able to have.
You know what? Sorry, Garvin, you cut out for a little while. Will you start over again? I apologize.
Yes, no problem. I'm wondering, Ms. Goldberg, if you could tell us which countries in particular, we all suspect the usual suspects of North Korea and China, but which countries, if any, are particularly difficult in gaining access, not necessarily censorship, but, man, because of their disorganization or whatever that you just have a problem getting into, and I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. You know, we have different problems at different times. We do have people all over the world, but Paul Salopek, who we were just talking about, who's walking around the world, he was denied access by Iran to walk across Iran. So he's had to kind of alter his route and is now going to have to go through Armenia and Azerbaijan and then across the Caspian Sea because he can't go through Iran. So that is typical. You know, we do sometimes have trouble getting visas, but I think you can see from our history, we've been able to eventually get almost anywhere we need to go. We just recently came back both photographically and repertorially from Saudi Arabia, where it's not always easy to get for a story that we're doing on women in Saudi Arabia. So we are able to get pretty much everywhere with a few exceptions. You did mention North Korea, and I think that is another place that's very, very tough to get into. But eventually, we can get most places.
Given that most of your folks in the field are freelancers, does that mean you don't have to sign off on very strange expense reports for the kinds of crazy safety gear that people need and the survival equipment and all that?
You know, one of the things I'm really proud of is how well prepared our folks are to go into the field. One of the tragedies that I think we've seen with some of the deaths of journalists in covering conflict situations is some of those people who were killed were young people who just weren't prepared and who didn't have the backing of major news organization. That is the opposite of our situation. Our folks are well-trained, well-prepared. They have the equipment. They have insurance. I mean, they have the backing of the National Geographic. And I feel very confident that we're taking care of people who put themselves in those situations.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. Let's speak next with Casey in Dallas. Hi, Casey.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Fantastic and great afternoon to you, Ms. Goldberg.
Thank you.
And company.
What's on your mind, Casey?
Really interesting for me. I'm an advanced placement high school teacher, photography teacher. And I'm really interested in how to incorporate this into my classroom. I know that I have every single National Geographic for the last 10 years, and I use it in my classroom already.
So educational opportunities, I guess, lots of teachers do use National Geographic. Anything that Casey might not know about, Susan, that you would recommend to students or, I guess, geography classes, science classes probably use the magazine and the online properties?
You know, I don't know exactly what your specific question is, but I would be happy to hook you up with the folks in our education division who can talk with much greater knowledge than I can about exactly what programs they've got with teachers. I just know that they are extensive and they are nationwide. We're thrilled, actually, that you're using National Geographic in your classroom, and I hope that your students are able to, use what we're doing online as well. I think the experience on the tablet is really quite extraordinary. So they'll get pictures that they wouldn't get in the magazine. The graphics will come to life. They'll get another way of storytelling, and I hope that can be useful in the classroom as well.
Susan, do you think there will always be a paper version of National Geographic, or are you starting to think about a time when it's an online-only property?
Always is a big word, but I don't think that there is any consideration of an online-only future, at least right now. But I do think that print products everywhere are encountering this question. We are a profitable magazine. As I said, we have 60 million readers of our magazine worldwide every month. That doesn't go away overnight, and that doesn't go away in many, many years. So I think we have a very long way to go. I will say that, but I also know that ultimately it's a digital future. And when it's an all-digital future, I can't say. I think it's beyond my lifetime.
Talk a little bit about assignments. You alluded to this a little bit earlier, the ability to control someone's time. But I wonder how often someone who likes to work with you comes with a pitch and how often you have a discussion in your office about who to approach about doing a particular assignment.
It's a total two-way street. I would say it's about 50-50. So we do have writers and photographers that we use on a regular basis who pitch us stories all the time. And we'll take them up sort of as an executive team and talk about what might work and what might not. So there's that way of deciding to tell stories. And then the other way is something will happen, or we'll just decide, hey, this is a really important issue that we think we ought to be telling, and we'll go out and assign it. I mean, there's really about five things that we use to evaluate what stories that we're going to do. The first is that, I really want the stories that we're doing to be relevant. These should be stories that touch people's hearts, that move people, and that people really care about. The story should be urgent. This shouldn't be blue skies stuff that doesn't matter. There needs to be a reason to do the story when we're going to do it. The story, it should be part of the conversation, so a topical story, things that people are talking about. And then the two other things are we should do stories that other people can't do because either they don't have our visuals or our global reach or our resources. So we've got a unique space and we should exploit it. And then finally, the last thing is we've got to know who we are. National Geographic, whatever platform it's on, has a resonance and a meaning to people, and we need to live up to that brand promise.
Do you feel like there was a time or there has been a time in the past when National Geographic wasn't as urgent and maybe didn't have that, reason for telling a particular story today? Is that a flaw that you're looking to correct? Or
I wouldn't say it was a flaw. I think that, though, we're in a different space in media than we were before. People are confronted with a blizzard of information. They have no time. We've got to cut through that clutter and reach out and sort of grab people by the throat and say, hey, you've got to read this. You've got to know about this. And our stories need to reflect that kind of urgency. And it doesn't make them news stories, but they've got to be on the kinds of topics where people feel like, wow, I'm really curious about that, or I really need to know about that, or isn't that amazing? I've never seen anything like that. So those are the ways that I feel like we're confronting a different era in storytelling than was the case before.
Is there a right way to read the magazine? Some people sort of go through and read the article as it's presented, and other people will look at all the photo illustrations or pictures and then decide whether they want to read the copy or when they want to read the copy.
I think the right way to read the magazine is any way somebody wants to read it. there's a certain number of magazine readers who start at the back. I've always heard about them. A lot I don't really know how most people read the magazine. I do know, though, from just being, you know, in journalism all these years, people's eyes go first to the pictures. Then they go to the biggest headline. Then they go to the captions on the picture. And finally, they'll go to the text of a story. So that just, I mean, and that seems to be true whether you're talking about a broadsheet newspaper, you know, or a magazine. But first, the eye goes to the picture. And so that's something, of, obviously, that we pay an enormous amount of attention to.
It's human nature.
Exactly.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink. Why is it still unusual in 2015 for a woman to be hired into the position you hold today? It was a big deal. I mean, I'm, as a woman, I'm proud of you, but it, should it be a big deal?
No, and it just kills me. I'm so proud to be the editor, and I'm so humbled to be the editor of National Geographic. But no, it shouldn't be a big deal every time a woman is appointed to a big job or loses a big job in publishing. It seems to become a national story, and it does that because we're still such an anomaly, and it's very distressing. What makes it particularly unnerving, I guess, is that if you look at journalism schools and communication schools, about 65% of the graduates from journalism schools are female, and yet only 23% of journalism leadership at news organizations is female. So you go from 64% to 23%. That's, you know, that is like falling off a cliff. That is not a pipeline problem. That's a problem within our newsrooms, either of expectations or people taking themselves out or being pushed out. And so there's something wrong in our business that only 23% of newsroom leadership is female. And this is something I feel very passionately about. And the reason I'm a little bit disheartened is we're actually going backwards. 10 years ago, we had more female leadership of newsrooms than we do right now. And so I think this is an issue that, you know, now we're out of the throes of the financial crisis. It's still a tumultuous time in media, but it's always going to be. But we've got to put this back on the table as one of the issues we need to address.
Where do you think women are going?
Where are they going outside of journalism?
After journalism school and to that point where they're, you know, 20% of leadership.
You know, I think a lot of women are going into jobs that maybe have a little more stability, maybe a little more regular hours. I think they're doing all kinds of things. Women who are journalists can do lots of different things.
We're speaking this hour with Susan Goldberg, editor-in-chief of National Geographic Magazine and News. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink. If you would like to check out some behind-the-scenes action today, you can do that at our new KERA Think Tumblr. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
Live from the headquarters of NPR in Washington, D.C., you are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, here on the final day of our week in D.C., speaking with the editor-in-chief of National Geographic Magazine, Susan Goldberg. You could be part of the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet @ChrisBoydThink. Susan, when I was a kid, my grandparents had a giant bookcase groaning with back copies of National Geographic, and I thought that was interesting, and it was something that my sisters and I would look at when we visited. Imagine my surprise to find out that everybody else's grandparents had the same groaning bookcase. Why do people not throw these things away? You know, or recycle them, I should ask.
Well, it is so funny because when I became the editor of the magazine, I've learned basically three things. One is when you tell people you're the editor of National Geographic Magazine, they go, oh, my God, that's just so incredible, which is this daily high, really.
Mm-hmm, sure.
It is such a wonderful reinforcement. The second thing is they tell you that they have – you know, every issue since 1950 or 1930 or, you know, 1980, and that is happening all over the country. The third thing I've learned is if you're talking to a middle-aged man, you are likely to hear from him. Yes, you know what I'm going to say. The first place that he ever saw a female breast was in National Geographic magazine. I cannot tell you how many men have decided they needed to tell me this story.
But like they're the only one, right?
Like they're the only ones. But back to the magazines in the basement. I don't know exactly why people can't throw them away. We do live in a throwaway society, and yet this is this symbol of knowledge, I think, this repository of learning, and people are afraid to throw it away like it's a book, because in a way it really is a book. And I think it's lovely and it's a touching tribute. And in a weird way, it's a little bit of a double-edged sword, because when you're a wonderful legacy brand like this and people say, and my grandparents have all these magazines, what worries me is the thought balloon is you're old, you know, you're not current, you're not modern. And what I always want to say is, great, I'm thrilled you have those magazines, but you should follow us on Instagram. You should be our Facebook friend. You should follow us on Twitter, because we're out there in so many different ways, and we need to do a really good job of getting across the fact that we're not just in your grandmother's basement. We're on your kid's mobile phone.
Has that changed the way you think about how long stories need to be? I sometimes I'll post an article somewhere and people will put that TLDNR, you know what that stands for? Too long, did not read. And I'm always surprised that people will admit that they just wouldn't take the time to read something. Do you feel like people still have an appetite for long form content?
I do, but I think you raise a really interesting point. You know, the first thing I would say is, people have always not read long stories. We just didn't know it before, right? Huh. So when I was the editor of newspapers and before the internet, I would go to coffee shops or, you know, go to some public place and watch people read the newspaper, because that was the only way I could tell how they were consuming the product that I was putting out. Were they going to the jump of stories? Were they throwing away the sports section or reading the front page? Or were they doing the opposite, throwing away the front page and just reading the sports section? So that's how, you know, I would get my debt. Now, of course, we've got wonderful metrics that do tell us, whether we like it or not, exactly how people are using our digital products. And, you know, you do find out that not everybody sticks with the end of a long story. So what I think we've got to do on some of these digital products is, you know, create different versions that work for the platform that they're on. And sometimes that does mean a shorter story. We have just started posting our stories on Snapchat. Now, we're one of 11 brands that have a special deal with Snapchat, so the stories don't go away in seconds, but they stay up there for 24 hours. But we are cutting down the stories and making them shorter, because I think that is realistic. You know, in the perfect world, what we can do is post a shorter story, say for our mobile audience, and then say, if you want to read the whole thing, click here. That way people can get the best of both worlds.
Knowing what people are interested in and being able to have those amazing metrics so instantly after people respond to something, are you facing the what I call the broccoli or cookies question? On the one hand, you know, everybody wants cookies, and so maybe you serve your audience more of those. On the other hand, you know, broccoli is really good for a balanced diet, and people ought to have it whether they think they want it or not.
I think people should have broccoli and cookies. I mean, it's the, you know, if this is a question you always face as any kind of a journalist trying to put out information that will both inform and entertain people. And that is the business we're in, of informing and entertaining. So, yeah, I always pay a lot of attention to what people are clicking on. I think it's important. So I know, for example, that people love to come to nationalgeographic.com, and what drives them there most is animal stories. And the weirder the animal story, the more people really like it. Okay. That's fine, and people should come to us for animal stories. But at the same time, that's not going to prevent me from covering the earthquake in Nepal, or covering an avalanche on Mount Everest, or covering the Ebola crisis, and doing all those things across our platforms. We can do both things. It's not an or, it's an and.
800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Martha in Dallas. Hi, Martha.
Hi. Hi, Chris. We are very proud of you.
Thank you.
You're doing such a wonderful job there in Washington. And I wanted to tell your guest today that I was raised in Colombia, Colombian by birth. And I remember seeing that picture of that Afghan girl on the front in the cover of the magazine and being so enthralled and all the emotions that come with knowing that there are other people in the world and maybe some are better than you, but some are worse than you. All of those emotions were transferred to me from that picture. So thank you very much. It's an amazing magazine, and I am having the hardest time now that you have the digital editions. I'm having a hard time throwing them away, so I wanted to get from her some some cues of how to, some advice of how to get rid of this magazine, because I still get the pins. Thank you. I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Martha.
Well, you don't really have to throw them away if you don't want to, but, you know, I think people should do whatever it is they want to do with their magazines. You know, I think, though, it's interesting to, you know, hear how this listener reacted so emotionally to a picture that was taken in 1984 by Steve McCurry, Afghan Girl, one of the most, you know, famous pictures ever taken in the world. And it really speaks to the power of visual storytelling, the power of photography, how it transcends language, it transcends even literacy. And so that is something that's a strength we need to play to every single day, whether it's in print or online, because really people don't take pictures like we take, and they're not out in the field and they're not investing the time to get the kind of photography that we can. Photography as a means of storytelling, I think, is gaining power. As people view pictures more and more on their phones, I think we've got an ability to have an intimate connection with our readers in a way that we don't have with them in the magazine. So if you're looking at a picture on your phone, that's the same device where you document your life for yourself, for your family, and for your friends. And yet this is the device on which you're going to view our professional journalism. So that's a connection with people that we don't have with them, because their lives don't live in our yellow border, but their lives do live in their phones, and so does our journalism. I think there's really something there that will draw us closer with our readers.
I was surprised to learn that the earliest years of National Geographic, it was a text-only publication. I guess, you know, photographic technology didn't allow for mass production in print very easily. But I guess by the early 20th century, photographs were there.
Exactly. You know, the first issue of National Geographic, it's got sort of this, like, brown paper bag-colored cover, and it is. I have to say, it's not a page turner, at least by modern standards. What's interesting, though, is how long it took people to really accept photography. I think it was in 1906. The editor of the magazine decided to put in decided to show off this crazy new technology in the magazine, and he published 74 photographs of animals taken at night with flash photography, which was then brand new. Apparently, two members of the National Geographic Society board quit in disgust, saying that the magazine was being turned into a dumbed-down picture book. So it just shows you how far we've come and what people have valued. It's been an incredible, you know, people always talk about disruption now in the media business. National Geographic was an incredible disruptor in its times. You know, we were the first people to have a photograph taken, you know, under the ocean. We were the first people to have a photograph, certain kinds of color aerial photography. We were the first people to do all kinds of photography. So we've been media disruptors for a long time.
It's also true, and this may not have ever been the intention, at least early on, but more than a century of photography has documented a lot of places and cultures that have changed and really been decimated over time.
You know, we do document cultures that are in trouble. We had a wonderful story last year of a tribe called the Kayapo who are in the Amazon, who are threatened by logging and development. I mean, we go all over the world reaching peoples who really are often not reached, and looking at the trouble that they're in, whether that's because of climate change or People are growing cocaine and driving Native and Indigenous people off their lands. In November, we're going to do a story. We're going to do a whole issue about climate change. We're going to look at two groups that are really affected by climate change. One is the people on the island of Kiribati who are going to have to flee because their island is sinking. And the other are people way up in the Arctic whose whole lifestyle is imperiled because of the melting of the glaciers and the rising of the seas.
What's your philosophy on the use of beauty to capture something that, you know, in reality may be something very sad and heartbreaking? The photographs in National Geographic, even when they depict disturbing things, tend to be very beautiful.
I think the point is to draw people into the stories and not to repel them. And so I think while we've got to tell difficult stories, maybe it's about the slaughter of elephants and rhinos, we've got to figure out a way to tell that story so it won't make people put down the magazine. I want them to keep going in the magazine. I do believe people can look at difficult photographs, and we show them difficult photographs all the time. But yes, in their own way, they are beautiful. They are beautifully shot. They're beautifully composed. They have resonance and meaning and layers of information in them. But just flat out blood and gore, there's no reason for us to do that. I want people to read our stories.
People used to love and collect the pull-out maps and supplements that would come in the magazine. You're not doing as much as before?
We still really do have them. Just about every issue we have a gatefold, one of the fold-out things. We don't do quite as many maps as we used to. We've got a wonderful one coming up in our climate change issue that will be about the Amazon and how the Amazon is so important to the world's ecosystem and so important on the issue of climate change. But every month we've got one. We had a terrific one last year that's very topical right now. It was in a story about the California drought, and it was a huge pullout, and it showed how California's system relies on snow falling in the Sierra that then trickles down, into the cities, and why right now California is in so much trouble. So I think these are one of the things that people can get in National Geographic that they just can't get anywhere.
It must be exciting for your graphics folks who now can use animated graphics and things for the other editions that were not available to them when it was only paper.
It's bringing graphics to life is super exciting. I mean, the other thing we really haven't talked about is the role of video in our storytelling. Increasingly, a lot of our photographers are doing not just still photography, but videography as well. And we also have a separate video team. So when I look at what drives people to the website and what they click on, videos is one of the most popular things. It opens an entirely new avenue of storytelling for us.
And do you have one particular story that's upcoming in a future edition that you will share with us that we can look out for?
Well, let's see. I've already tipped my hand. I told you all about the Pope story. That I am very excited about the Pope story because I think it's so unique. But I'm also excited about our June cover story, which is on the science of marijuana, another really relevant and topical story, because you've got states all over the United States legalizing marijuana, taxing marijuana, and you've got yet the federal government with a classification on marijuana, so it can't even be studied. This story looks at the science of marijuana and what it actually does to your brain and body. I think it's a terrific issue.
Susan Goldberg is editor-in-chief of National Geographic Magazine and News. Susan, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I was pleased to be here.
Our think team in Washington includes Stephen Becker and Jeff Whittington. We want to thank all the people from NPR who've made this week possible. Back in Dallas, the show's engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor. You can check out the KERA Think Tumblr to check out behind-the-scenes action from this week. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd in Washington. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.